how do you write about or around information that's classified?
Well, there's nothing in planet Earth that's classified. It's unknown, maybe, because the military's quite secretive, but now that we have web pages, for example, you can go to U.S. Naval Research, and you can even put HAARP in and find out what's going on in Alaska. So it's a matter of putting it all together. It is available, but it's not in our usual media. That's, I think, the problem. And what I've noticed is a lot of the abnormal weather and things that people are calling climate change are really due to military experimentation. But the problem is the persons who try to figure out what's going on are usually academics, and they look at only the civilian economy. For example, the rockets and supersonic flight was a big factor in the depletion of the ozone layer, but what came out in our paper was, you know, underarm deodorant in your refrigerator. So it's there's always a secrecy curtain between the civilian economy and the military economy.
Mm-hmm. And how do individuals begin to look for and look at what's happening with the military economy? What kind of sources do you look to try to fill in those gaps?
Well, you might have to look at professional papers. I remember I was in Australia at one point, and they announced in the newspaper that there was going to be an experiment, and the in Tasmania there's a very large astrophysical laboratory, and they were going to be looking at the stars without anything in the way. And so I looked in the newspaper and found the names of the people who came from the United States to watch this wonderful experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And then later I followed up what they were writing in the Astrophysics Journal. And they pretty much put everything in there that they were doing. They were, trying to clear the ozone layer, actually, and make a clear path to look at the stars and distant astronomical things. But, you know, if you use your common sense, and this is a really good thing, they'd do it over Washington.
Now, why do you think so often it seems like with experiments like this, there's not a regard for safety or, you know, the common sense of that we'd be damaging the ozone layer or damaging the life support systems of the Earth? Any theories on that?
Well, that bothered me for a long time. And what I found was the military thinks that they're preventing major bomb on New York or Los Angeles or Toronto, or, you know, and so once you put that on one side of the balance, you could do almost anything on the other side. So I think that in their minds, all of this is protection and national security.
I see what you mean. Do you believe in the Gaia theory, that the Earth is a living organism?
Well, it certainly has all the characteristics of a living organism, other than reproduction. We don't have any hopes that it's going to make another Earth.
Uh-huh.
But it breathes, it takes in sunlight, it gives off hydrogen at the outer edges. So it's... you know, it is a living, breathing planet, and it also supports a tremendous amount of life.
Would you talk a little bit about the different types of weapons or the ways that the military is using the Earth as a weapon?
Well, much of what the military is doing now, and this isn't just the United States, but they're using Tesla theories. Tesla lived in the early 1900s, and he had developed scalar waves, and he boasted of being able to split the Earth in half, given enough of these waves. So they've been experimenting with them in different ways. The U.S. and in Russia have developed HAARP is the U.S. instrument, and we gave a name Woodpecker to the one in Russia, and these are towers that are placed in a very even grid, and they're broadcasting towers. But there's, well, when I first saw HAARP, it had 48 in a grid, 6x8 of these broadcasting towers. The most recent size is 150, and there's talk of making it still larger. And they're synchronized, and what they do is send synchronized electromagnetic radiation up to the ionosphere, which is the outer layer of protection of the Earth. It actually lifts up the ionosphere and then kind of drops it down again. There's also a wave that comes back from the ionosphere to the Earth, and they're using that for what they call deep Earth tomography. It's kind of like a CAT scan of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So they can find underground deposits of oil and gas. They can also communicate with submarines, which are, you know, underwater. And but they have other possibilities. They can disrupt communication over a large area of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They can begin to use that to steer the jet stream. And of course, the jet stream you see every night on your news, and the people above it are colder, and the people below it are warmer. So it's got a significant effect on climate. In the U.S., there's also a whole series of what they call superdrones. These are stations which operate for 24/7. They're in Iceland, Greenland, and northern Canada. I think there's one in Goose Bay, Kapuskasing. Saskatoon. I'm not sure about the one in Prince William because they talked about it, but I don't know if they actually built it. And then the last one is out on Kodiak Island in Alaska. And these operate continuously to see what happens on the surface of the Earth when they do manipulations of the ionosphere. And all of the information is fed into Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, where it's analyzed and where they give feedback to the people that are using the HAARP facility. So it's a pretty, you know, they're actually learning. They're learning how to manipulate the big systems of the Earth.
And so the superdrones monitor all the activity that comes out of HAARP?
They monitor what happens on Earth when HAARP sends an electromagnetic wave to the ionosphere.
And presumably they could be monitoring when other countries use their HAARP-like facilities as well?
I think so. Clearly, Russia has about three of these, but I don't think they're as large as HAARP. There's also one in Puerto Rico. I think there's one in Antarctic, but I can't prove that. But there, you know, this is, again, another thing. There's also big vapor rivers that are about 3 miles above the surface of the Earth, and they bring the water from the tropics up to the mid-latitudes. And they're very important. There's five in the northern hemisphere and five in the southern hemisphere. So if they slightly change the course of those vapor rivers, they could cause drought or they could cause flooding.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have a lot of possibilities. And I suspect that some of the things that are that people are attributing to climate change as the result of this experimentation.
Mm-hmm. When you had mentioned the lifting the ionosphere using HAARP, what's the purpose of lifting it, or what kind of an effect do they get from making the ionosphere lift up?
I don't know. It certainly disrupts communication.
Uh-huh.
But they're also trying to form lenses in the ionosphere so that they can send energy up and it will come back down in, somewhere in the Earth. So it's something like radio works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, radio waves bounce off the ionosphere. But there's all kinds of speculation of what they would do with this. One is wherever the military is located, they could provide them with almost unlimited energy. Another would be it could be used to what they call deposit energy, which is like a bomb, any place on the Earth. So there are possibilities that are scary for this.
And when you say unlimited energy, this is like having wireless power.
Right.
I see. In one of your talks, I heard you speak about 1995, the power outage, and you were linking that possibly to a military experiment with the ionosphere, I believe. Could you talk more about that?
Well, that was a very strange happening, if you remember. It was the whole West Coast, I think two provinces in Canada and about eight states in the United States. And they never did explain it. They just said it was a sudden surge of energy and it took down all the grids. But it coincided with their turning on the HAARP for the first time. And that's why I was suspicious, because HAARP ties into the electrojet, which is a direct current electricity that you can access at the poles. So I think what they did is they made a mistake and they wiped out the grids on the whole West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't prove that. It just was a very funny coincidence when they first turned this thing on.
And is there any place that records when HAARP is on and when it's off?
When I was up there, I asked that. And at that time, they said they were only allowed to operate four times a year, but that could be changed by executive order in an emergency. So it's not easy to find out.
And what is their stated intention for what they're using HAARP for?
It's a university experiment on the aurora borealis.
Mm-hmm. So, what other ways do you collect information for your book?
Well, some of it, you know, you already know about, and then you find the, you know, new ways to use things like radar and over the horizon radar, things like that. You also, you know, you build on what knowledge you have, but you also can get hold of symposium papers that actually hold symposiums periodically on HAARP. They have, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, they had one on geoengineering, which they're now offering to people to, cure climate change. They're going to do geoengineering. Well, they have actually been doing geoengineering for the last 60 years. So I wouldn't let them touch the Earth system.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of evidence do you have of geoengineering going back to 60 years ago?
Well, it started with General Electric discovering that you could seed clouds and make rain. It got quite highly developed during the Vietnam War, and there is a whole book by, I think his name is Lionel Ponte, and it's called The Cooling, and they actually tried to remove the ozone layer over Vietnam to spoil the crops, and they had another project called Storm Fury. They tried to increase the violence of the monsoons, and they had another one that used lightning. So that was back in the 70s, and that is what spurred the United Nations to pass that law that you couldn't use manipulation of the environment as a weapon. So then after that, they had all kinds of reasons for doing it. They were helping the wheat to grow in U.S. and Canada. They were, helping to ease droughts. They were doing all kinds of really good things, but they were also learning how to manipulate the environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like even if you're helping to ease a drought, but no action is not going to be without a reaction somewhere else in the earth.
Right, right. We're all connected.
Are there any more recent storm events or power outages that you would say would be connected to military weather manipulation?
Well, about a year ago in September 2009, the Navy had a project which they called CARE, C-A-R-E, which is an acronym for something I can't recall. But it went up, they sent a rocket up from the naval base in Virginia, and they created artificial clouds made of aluminum oxide about 500 miles above the Earth's surface. Now, normal clouds reach a height of about 50 miles above. Anyway, this happened in late September in 2009.
Excuse me, you said normal clouds are 50 miles above. How far above were their clouds?
500.
Okay.
So it's very high, which means it made a very large shadow over the East Coast. And I don't know what happened in Canada, but all of our normal fall rain turned into snow. And I remember Baltimore had to borrow snow removal equipment from Canada because they didn't even own any.
Wow.
So I'm sure it interrupted the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Aluminum wood is something that would reflect the sun's rays upward instead of letting them come down to the earth. So I don't know how big it was. I know they had it on their webpage of the U.S. Naval Research. And then after I started talking about it, they took it off their webpage. So sometimes you have to catch these things pretty quickly.
Uh-huh. What other materials are being put into the atmosphere for military experimentation?
They use a lot of barium and aluminum. They seem to be the two chief ones. I should say the U.S. had a program with Canada, too, up in Churchill, Manitoba, and they sent rockets up to with radioactive material as tracers to something like you'd do a scan of a human body, find out where things go.
Mm-hmm.
And they did these tracer experiments out of Churchill for several years.
I see. And so barium and aluminum are the two primary things that are being experimented?
They're very toxic, and of course they come down. They don't stay up there. They come down on the water and the crops, and they're not coming in large amounts, but they do affect people and animals.
And is barium a radioactive element?
No, but it's highly toxic.
I see. And so what kind of effects does that have on the living creatures on the Earth?
Well, some creatures are pretty small, and it's probably enough to kill them. The same dose to a large animal would probably have some effect, but not be lethal. So, you know, you have such a variety of sizes that you can't make a generalized statement.
Mm-hmm. You spoke before about chlorine in the atmosphere, or chlorine gases.
The chlorine gas was one of the principal gases they used in World War I.
And what was the purpose for them using that?
Well, it's a heavy gas. It stays near the Earth, and it would go down into the trenches and kill all the soldiers in the trenches. It's a horrible kind of thing.
Rosalie, I have a caller. I'm going to try to take this call, so
okay.
Stay with me a moment. The caller wanted me to ask you about aluminum having the property to break the blood-brain barrier. Are you familiar with that?
Well, aluminum is found in the brains of people on autopsy that have had Alzheimer's disease. So I suspect it has to be a nano-sized particle of aluminum to go through the blood-brain barrier. If you breathe in those nanoparticles, though, which is the more likely way you would get it, it can go up the olfactory channels from the nose right to the brain,
mm-hmm.
which is what I think is happening to our servicemen coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. The nanoparticles of depleted uranium are probably doing minimal brain damage.
Mm-hmm. The second part of the caller's question was about how the body works with electromagnetic fields and how these kind of technologies would possibly affect the human body in that regard.
Well, the body itself is electric. And so there are electromagnetic waves which are between 0 and 100 hertz that can affect the electrical circuits in the body. They can disrupt circadian rhythm, heartbeat, breathing, you know, other things that have a rhythm to them.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about the effects that the atomic weapons have had on the ionosphere or atmosphere?
Well, the estimate is that the atmospheric nuclear tests, all of them, depleted the ozone layer by 4%. They didn't wipe it out, but once you've taken 4% of it away, it becomes vulnerable to other things. It's also affected by the rockets and by the supersonic planes. This was in our newspapers back in the 70s when they were trying to get commercial airlines to adopt supersonic flight, and only one did. But that was why they didn't, because it was known at that point that it would deplete the ionosphere. I'm sorry, the ozone layer.
And does the ozone over time ever seem to be rebuilding itself?
I think it's getting worse. But there's a lot of activity. We don't even know the number of rockets that are set up every year. The only ones that are highlighted in the news are the, the ones from Cape Canaveral, but there are a lot of others that are set up during the year. And I think the supersonic planes, the military is having exercises all the time, and they're, using those planes. So that's all damaging for the ozone layer.
Are there any types of citizen watchdog groups that are up on these kind of issues and advocating for public awareness or prevention of this kind of behavior from the military?
There's a DOE watch. There are chemtrail watches. The recent, Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, it was Teller that's proposing that they use geoengineering to mitigate climate change. And I think that should have been a red flag. Anybody who knew Teller, he knows all the stuff the military's doing.
Uh-huh.
So there is a group in Montreal, Hands Off Mother Earth, that has been quite good at raising awareness of geoengineering. So I think that will eventually include the military. Right now it's including all those scientists who are waiting for grants to do these things like painting the clouds white so they reflect up the light, or covering the ocean with plankton. And I mean, there's all kinds of money, hopefully for the scientists, that's going to flow their way to do these kinds of things to the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, everything you do to block the sun is going to ruin people's solar-powered energy.
Right. I didn't even consider that.
No.
One time when I was doing a radio program here, someone had told me that I was broadcasting classified information, which was something I found on the internet. And, it's... have you ever been accused of sending around classified information or threatened in any way that you can't talk about what you're talking about?
Well, I have FBI clearance because I worked with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on worker and public health exposures to radiation. So I do have clearance. And I'm pretty careful not to go over the line.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's an awful lot of military information out there that's not classified, that they kind of brag about, and it's certainly you can use that.
Right. And do you happen to know what kind of penalties there are for speaking about classified information?
Well, in a sense, I think it's tyranny, or it's you're We don't have an official Secrets Act, but the Atomic Energy Act said even if you found out what the radiation did in your own laboratory, the information was born classified.
Hmm.
I had never heard that term before,
mm-hmm.
but it's born classified.
Hmm.
I think people need to know what radiation does, and my original work was on medical diagnostic X-ray, and I felt quite free to talk about medical X-rays. People can transfer their learning into what else is going on in terms of nuclear power and nuclear weapon testing.
Mm-hmm. And I believe I was reading in a biography about you on the internet somewhere that you helped to end X-rays in shoe stores.
Oh, yeah, that was... they had a hearing in the U.S. Congress, and they were trying to limit X-rays because by that time people knew that it was serious. And so quite a few things happened after that meeting. They did... It was a political way of doing it. They told the people that had these X-rays in the shoe stores that they had to have them checked by a radiation professional, I think twice a year. Well, that was an expense, and so they all moved them out.
Uh-huh.
And they also stopped chest X-rays on admission to the hospital for all federal hospitals, then all state hospitals, and then the other hospitals followed suit. They stopped the mobile X-rays, chest X-rays for the schools. They used to go around to the high schools and do X-ray. They stopped a lot of things at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now it's kind of creeping up again, and they're using especially CAT scans more frequently than they're really needed.
And what type of energy is used, or energy is used with the CAT scan? Is that an X-ray?
Yes.
Okay.
A lot of X-rays. And then they put them together to give a three-dimensional picture.
I see.
I mean, they're very useful, but it's not a camera, and they're not just taking pictures.
Mm-hmm. And aren't there other alternatives to having a CAT scan? Other ways of imaging the body that maybe aren't as harmful?
Well, they have the MRI, and I don't know that the research is done yet on what kind of harm that does.
Uh-huh.
I can't believe it does none, but it's certainly not X-ray.
Right.
So these things are introduced to solve one problem, but they can very well have other side effects that we just haven't found yet.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things should be used with care. If you need it, you have it. If you're going to have brain surgery, you want a picture.
Uh-huh.
People can tell the difference between a knife that's used for surgery and a knife that's just used to attack somebody. So it's not the instrument so much as using it sensibly.
Uh-huh. And what do you have a particular view on the danger of using X-rays for teeth at the dentist?
You don't hit as much bone marrow. However, as you get older, you have a lot of lead fillings, and they're not really very efficient, because the lead blocks the X-ray and you don't see what was behind it. So I personally ask the dentist to just look and see if he finds a cavity, and mm-hmm. not to just depend on X-ray. And I haven't had any trouble yet, and I'm 81 years old.
Wonderful. What are the other books that you wrote besides The Planet Earth?
No Immediate Danger. prognosis for a radioactive Earth. That's on the radiation and the nuclear questions.
And both of those are about radiation and nuclear?
Yes. And then I've written some professional books, like a handbook for calculating the dose of ionizing radiation for various exposures. And I wrote a math textbook. You know, so I've done some other things, but really two popular books.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's 9:42. At this point, I'd like to let the listeners know you're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. My host, my guest is Dr. Rosalie Bertel, and we're speaking about things relating to her research and her books and her latest book, which has been recently revised, Planet Earth, the Latest Weapon of War. And if you'd like to call in here and you have a question for Dr. Bertel or myself, the telephone number is area code 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. Is there anything about chemtrails? You mentioned Chemtrail Watch that you've come across in your research.
Well, there's certainly something unusual going on. It's they're not regular discharge from a jet engine, because that doesn't persist more than a few seconds. These can last half an hour. So there's a huge difference between the discharge. The other thing is you don't usually get these big crosses in the sky and two parallel lines and, all kinds of funny things. If you go in northern New York State, near the military, Fort Drum up there? They do it pretty low there. And you can actually see these clouds dripping something down. Now, you're not going to find anybody with clearance from a government agency telling you what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Many people have seen them, and most independent scientists won't touch it because they would lose their funding and probably their job. But many amateurs have tested the soil and, again, found aluminum and barium oxides. So it's a distribution system of some kind. I think I suspect it's practice for biological or chemical warfare. And what they're using now is most likely something to reflect the sun rays up. But we don't know what the chemtrails are. It was interesting. I was in Germany a couple of weeks ago, and when the plane took off from Frankfurt, the sky was just crisscrossed with these things. And when I landed in Philadelphia, there wasn't a one could be seen. But then we found out President Obama was landing at the same time in the Philadelphia airport.
Oh, wow.
So we had a circle, and the airport was frozen, and it caused great chaos. But there was not a sign of one of those chemtrails in the sky, which made me think.
Right. When you talk about the X-rays being just a normal part of going to get a pair of shoes, what type of parallels do you see today with something that could be as dangerous as that the general public is just seeing as something that's not a threat or danger?
Probably the cell phones, and especially for children. Children are very susceptible to the radiation of the brain. That's non-ionizing radiation, but the brain is quite an electrical entity, and it can interfere with the brain waves. So I think cell phones are used as toys almost, and children use them pretty frivolously.
It seems like it. And would the same kinds of things apply for other wireless technologies such as Wi-Fi and...
Yeah, I think Wi-Fi is a really bad idea. You know, I'd rather have the electricity in a wire than all over the place, you know.
Right.
It seems to me kind of, you know, asking for trouble.
True. Is there any other authors' books that you would recommend on these different topics?
There's a book, Under the Radar, which is put out by the Rutgers University Press, and it's written by Ellen something. I can't remember her last name, but it's excellent on the development of radiation medicine, all the different ways it was used to control cancers, and the things that happened in the beginning were really pretty horrible. The radiologists were sticking their arms under the machine to make sure the machine was working, and many of them had to have their arms amputated. But I mean, there are all kinds of the whole history of it is very interesting and very kind of scary.
Mm-hmm. I do have a caller. One moment. Okay, so sorry, we lost you, but our last caller wanted to know, because Tesla had this idea of providing wireless power to everyone, is there a danger to having wireless power? Is that something he didn't foresee the danger of that, or is it not dangerous, and what is the danger with Wi-Fi?
Well, Tesla sent the power through the Earth. There's a meeting, I think it's next February in Barcelona, on free energy. And it's the first time there's been such a meeting. But Tesla was actually a pacifist, and he thought if he could provide everybody with free energy and he could create these weapons that were so horrible nobody would want to use them, that there would be peace and prosperity on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So he had good intentions. Now, I think he sent the his plan was to send the energy through the Earth itself instead of through wires, which, if that works, would certainly be better than the Wi-Fi, which is covering the living space.
Mm-hmm. And what are the some of the dangers of Wi-Fi, or a place that you could learn about the dangers of Wi-Fi?
Well, any kind of non-ionizing radiation, its major effect is to disrupt circadian rhythm. That might be sleep, could be menstrual cycle, it could be heart rate, it could be respiratory rate. So anything that's you know, cyclical and constant in the human body can be disrupted.
And what's the difference between non-ionizing and ionizing radiation?
Ionizing is strong enough to knock one of the electrons, at least one electron, out of orbit, give it an escape velocity. And so you end up with two pieces of matter. One is positively charged, which is the main part of the atom, and then the electron is negatively charged. So whereas non-ionizing radiation can cause the electrons to vibrate in place, but which creates heat, but they don't give them enough energy to actually escape from the shell of the atom.
Mm-hmm. In your research, is there any military things with the planet that you see in regards to nanotechnology?
Well, I think nanotechnology is going to cause many problems. First of all, nanoparticles, everybody knows what particulates can do, and, you know, in fact, they usually give warnings of particulates in the air. Anything below 10 micron you can breathe in, and below 2.5 micron can go down into the deep parts of the lungs. Now, when you talk about nanoparticles, you're talking about 1,000 times smaller. And they can actually move from the bloodstream into the cells themselves. They can pass the blood-brain barrier, the lung-blood barrier, cross the placenta to the fetus. So they're a very serious kind of move to make in medicine.
And are there any scientists or professionals in this field that would give any type of a hearing to Congress? Because I would imagine that most people in Congress wouldn't understand the implications of the dangers of nanoparticles, and I guess the average U.S. citizen has an eighth grade science education.
Well, there are books on it, and I don't know. You know, the scientist is in the position of talking against what brings him his salary. So they're put in a pretty funny position.
Right. Is there anything that citizens can do about the dangers that we hear about in your work about military geoengineering and such?
Well, I think once you have been clued into the things that are happening, you'll see it in the newspaper, because they're often very short, you know, little articles that tell you something's going on. And if you do see something, you know, go to the computer and find out more about it. So don't just be lulled into thinking everything's fine. I think to be alert and to share information with your friends and relatives and stay alert to what's happening. I feel sorry for young people who are going into the military with, you know, really great aspirations and loyalty and patriotism, and they're coming out sick.
Mm-hmm. Are there any efforts in other countries where they have citizens have worked to put a moratorium on this kind of work that you're aware of?
Well, Canada stopped using DU nanoparticles after the first Gulf War, and so did Great Britain, but the U.S. is still using it and still claiming there's no harm.
I see. And isn't there some type of a documentary on the effects of DU?
Well, Snowshoe Films has one that's on the Internet. There are others, too. There's a lot of personal testimony of some of the veterans who have returned. There's, you know, these things are available, but you have to look for them.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you'd like to speak about that I hadn't asked you about?
Well, I just like to tell people that the Earth is a pretty great place the way it is, and I don't think we're making any kind of good future by messing with it. It's a very efficient supporter of life, and most anything we do is going to cause trouble. And I mean on a large scale. I don't mean that we can't do things that are local that improve the quality of life. But these large-scale things are going to have winners and losers, because the Earth is pretty well balanced.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you.
And that was Dr. Rosalie Bertel speaking to us over the telephone. Her recent book is Planet Earth, The Latest Weapon of War.